We live in a country where one can look at, you know, prisons if we are to have them and not see an 8-to-1 ratio. Until we can, you know, look at a country and not, you know, see black men comprising roughly 8% of the world's, you know, in prison population, until, you know, we can, you know, have a situation in which, you know, I can turn on the news or come on this show and be able to discuss other things besides, you know, Sandra Bland being threatened with being, you know, to light her up, as he said, over a turn signal, until we have a situation in which Tamir Rice, you know, who's out playing, you know, is not, you know, effectively committing a lethal crime, you know, a crime that threatens his life. You know, until we have a situation where, you know, Ka'Jimmy Powell, for mere fact of being mentally ill, is not shot down in the street. Until we have, you know, a situation in which, you know, John Crawford, you know, who is shopping in Walmart, is not shot down and executed in a store. Progress is nice, but it's, you know, to be noted, and the struggle continues after that.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, we thank you so much for being with us. National correspondent for The Atlantic, his book is called Between the World and Me. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like a copy of the show, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, San Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Special thanks to Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera.
Time is 5 o'clock. You're tuned into KBOO Portland. Up next, the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Summer Concert in Dawson Park, featuring a live performance by Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. The mission of Summer Concerts in the Park is to bring cultural diversity to metropolitan area residents. Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band play a full range of popular and traditional salsa, son cubano, timba, and tropical styles as cumbia, merengue, y bachata. Again, that's the Summer Concert in Dawson Park with Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. Dawson Park is located at North Stanton and North Williams Avenue in Portland. More information about ticket prices and directions can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 12th annual PDX Pop Now Festival, July 24th through 26th at Audio Cinema in Portland. PDX Pop Now includes a record fair, street fair, and two outdoor stages with performers such as Amber Moon, Blue Cranes, Long Knife, Mike Crenshaw, Nurses, The Stops, and many more. That's PDX Pop Now, July 24th through 26th at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on KBOO Evening News, Shell Oil has been granted the final permit needed to drill in the Arctic as soon as its icebreaker ship completes repairs in the Port of Portland. Senate Republicans moved to gut a key provision of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, which was created to regulate the financial industry. Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2015, and I'm Joseph Jordan. The U.S. Department of the Interior has granted Royal Dutch Shell its final two permits to explore for oil in the Arctic, but with the caveat that they must wait for emergency equipment to arrive before they can start drilling. Shell discovered weeks ago that the Fennica icebreaker that holds the required equipment had a 3-foot gash in its hull and sent it to Portland, Oregon for repairs. Shell does not expect to have the ship back until August. Activists in Oregon have vowed to take direct action, possibly with a kayak blockade, to stop the icebreaker ship when it arrives in Portland to repair the crack in its steel hull. There will be a protest called Portland versus Shell on Thursday, July 23rd, from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Laurelhurst Park at Southeast Cesar Chavez Boulevard and Southeast Oak Street.
More than 3,200 employees of the University of California will see their wages go up to $15 an hour over the next 2 years. Janet Napolitano, president of the University of California, announced the move this morning. The move affects not only direct employees of the university, but also contract employees. It will cost an estimated $14 million, which university officials said would not come from state funding or tuition. The University of California, which has 10 campuses across the state, is one of the largest universities in the country with more than 200,000 students and 150,000 employees. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo made a similar move this morning, recommending that the minimum wage for fast food workers also rise to $15. If the New York raise goes through, it will affect as many as 180,000 workers.
Two local citizens groups have been campaigning to raise Oregon's minimum wage. This week, Raise the Wage announced a campaign for a $13.50 minimum wage and an end to the state's preemption law. The other group, 15 Now, responded that any amount under $15 per hour is insufficient. Both groups oppose the preemption law, which prevents local governments from raising their minimum wages above the state minimum wage. I spoke with 15 Now's Jamie Partridge to ask him about the preemption law and what the effect of a $15 minimum wage might be. Again, the first question is can you talk a little bit about what 15 Now is?
Sure. 15 Now is a campaign that's nationwide. In Oregon, we kicked it off a year and a half ago with the Nick Caleb campaign for city council, where he raised $15 minimum wage demand as part of his platform. Have expanded throughout Oregon from Portland to Salem to Eugene to Medford to Bend, Hood River, LaGrand. And we're a statewide campaign now to raise the minimum wage in Oregon to 15.
There's this other group that was looking to raise the wage to $13.50, and why is that not enough?
If you look at the studies, the Alliance for a Just Society, the National Low Income Housing Coalition, the University of Washington School of Social Work, the Oregon Center for Public Policy, they all say that at least $15 is needed to bring a worker out of poverty in the state of Oregon. That is, get people off public assistance, so the food stamps, Section 8 housing, child care subsidy, Oregon health plan. $15 is needed across the state, and we hear this from workers in the city of Portland. We hear this from farm workers. One of our major coalition partners is the Farm Workers Union. We also hear it from restaurant workers, from Walmart workers, from McDonald's workers. Well, close to half the workers in the state make less than $15, and its cost of living is skyrocketing, and wages aren't going up.
And one of the things you said is this started with a city council campaign in Portland, and Portland can't raise its own minimum wage on its own. Is that right?
That's correct. We thought that we could do that. We found there was a law. We thought we could raise the minimum wage to 15, like Seattle did, like San Francisco did, like Los Angeles has done in recent months. But there's a law in the state of Oregon and in about 19 other states that prohibits cities from raising their minimum wage higher than that of the state. So while we're trying to get that law changed, we're also trying to go for $15 in the state, across the state. And we've been to the state legislature in the last session, even though the Democrats were in the majority and campaigned on raising the minimum wage. There was no raise in the minimum wage at the state legislature this session, despite the fact that we had many sponsors for a $15 minimum wage bill. We had hundreds of folks show up at the Capitol numerous times, including packing hearing rooms and having scores of low-wage workers tell their story about how what they make at work is not enough to get by. The Democrats didn't come across in the legislature, so we decided to file a ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage to $15 over 3 years.
And what's the timeline like on that ballot initiative?
We have to collect 88,000 signatures on a petition by July of 2016, and to get it onto the November of 2016 ballot.
And how are you coming along with that?
Well, we filed our initial 1,000 signatures a week ago, and we're moving forward, waiting for. Well, actually, we have to wait for the Attorney General to issue a ballot title, and as soon as we get that ballot title, we'll move forward all across the state. We, in our first 1,000 signatures, we collected. We got signatures from folks in all 36 counties, so we know that there's support out there across the state for raising the minimum wage, because no worker should live in poverty.
And one of the things I'm curious about is what happens, have you reached out to the Raise the Wage people at all about melding your movements, or what happens if you both end up on the ballot, you know?
Yes, many of the same organizations are in both Raise the Wage Coalition and our Oregonians for 15. There's a lot of unions involved. There's community organizations and faith-based organizations and business organizations. And undoubtedly both campaigns will be raising public awareness about the need to raise wages. We're standing strong for 15 because that's what's needed to get workers out of poverty in this state.
And what do you expect to have happen here in Oregon if you do get this $15 minimum wage instituted? How would people's lives change?
Well, it would put an additional $3.2 billion in the pockets of people who are most likely to spend it in their communities, low-wage workers. And, of course, that means that businesses will prosper as well, particularly small businesses. You know, whereas people now have to go to Walmart or McDonald's to get low-priced food, they'll be able to go to locally owned businesses. Studies have shown that across the country, when the minimum wage is raised, and even when it's raised substantially, like this would do, that businesses prosper because the consumers have more money in their pocket to spend. Taxpayers will benefit because currently low-wage workers cost $1.7 billion a year to the state of Oregon with government assistance such as food stamps, the Oregon Health Plan, and child care subsidy and Section 8 housing. So there'll be a reduction in cost to the taxpayer. There'll be more money in circulation in the economy. And, of course, low-wage workers will be able to pay their rent and put food on the table, pay their medical expenses, pay for education.
So I take it you don't give any credit to the people who say this is going to hurt small businesses and things like that?
No. The businesses that do say that are countered by businesses in our coalition who have seen it. In Oregon, we raised the minimum wage between 1989 and 91, just about the same amount, 20% per year, and the economy prospered. In the country, the minimum wage was doubled in the year 1950, and the economy prospered. So the studies show that despite all the fears that business owners have, that they're going to have to lay people off, that their businesses will collapse, it just has not been shown to be true in practice.
I'd like to leave with this. Is there a question that I haven't asked, or something that maybe it seems like I'm not understanding that you wished I had asked?
Well, we just want folks to know that they can get involved, that we're you know, we're working on a minimum wage raise through collecting signatures on a petition. And if they'd like to get involved in the effort, they should go to Oregonians for 15.org, which is our website, and then the local Portland-based organization is 15nowpdx.org.
Oh, that was Jamie Partridge of 15 Now. For KBOO News, I'm Joseph Jordan.
The federal government sued an Oregon power company on Tuesday, blaming the company for a 2009 wildfire that broke out in the Umpqua National Forest. The company, PacifiCorp, owns a 35-year lease on the North Umpqua Hydroelectric Project. The government alleges that PacifiCorp and a local construction company failed to clear brush away from power lines in the area, and that those lines later caused the Williams Creek Fire. The Williams Creek Fire burned more than 8,000 acres and destroyed critical wildlife habitat. The government seeks damages that will be determined at trial. The move comes in the midst of what is expected to be one of the worst fire seasons in memory. A years-long drought and the hottest June on record have left the western United States a tinderbox, according to the National Interagency Fire Center.
The video of Sandra Bland's arrest in Texas shows the arresting officer pulling out his taser and shouting, quote, "I will light you up." Bland's sister said in a statement that it was evident the officer had specifically targeted Bland for harassment. The first video released by the police department was edited and did not show the officer shouting at Bland and then dragging her out of the car. When online viewers noticed discrepancies in the video footage, the police released the full unedited version. According to Bland's family, Waller County police have repeatedly tried to cover up and obscure the facts around Bland's death in police custody last week. As a prominent anti-police brutality activist, her supporters say that police specifically targeted her for assassination in order to, quote, send a message, unquote, to the Black Lives Matter movement. Now they say the sheriff's office is attempting to assassinate her character as well by claiming in their most recent statement that she told officers after her arrest that she had previously tried to commit suicide. The family of Sandra Bland said they were infuriated by the latest attempt by the sheriff's office to assassinate the character of Sandra Bland, who they firmly believe was murdered at the hands of police. Bland was arrested in Texas after failing to signal a lane change and was found dead in her cell days later. The sheriff's office ruled her death a suicide.
A 32-year-old man slipped into a detox center in Riverton, Wyoming last Saturday and shot two people in the head, killing one. Roy Clyde was a parks employee who said he targeted the detox center because he was tired of cleaning up after homeless people who drank in local parks. Both victims were members of the Northern Arapaho tribe, many of whom live on the nearby Wind River Indian Reservation. Alcohol is illegal on the reservation, so many tribe members travel to Riverton to drink. A Northern Arapaho spokesman says the tribe has contacted federal authorities about the possibility of pursuing hate crimes prosecution against Roy Clyde. Clyde told police he would have shot white people too had he found any.
Dylan Roof, the white man suspected of killing nine black people in a Charleston, South Carolina church last month, has been charged with federal hate crimes. South Carolina does not have a law addressing hate crimes. Federal officials say they believe the nine counts of murder that Roof had already been charged with failed to adequately address the racial aspects of the crime. Roof, 21, has been linked to a racist manifesto posted on the internet and posted photographs of himself wearing racist symbols to his website. He was also charged with murder while obstructing religious freedom.
A mechanical engineering student amazed the internet when he built a drone with a gun attached to it for a college project. His 13-second video was viewed over 2 million times and raises a flag concerning drone capabilities and the laws that regulate them. Some people consider it a case of technology outpacing laws, and local agencies are scrambling to find any laws that may apply. Currently, it does not appear that there are any laws that prevent someone from attaching a weapon to a remote-controlled drone. The drone in the video was used on private land in a controlled environment. Flying the drone was legal, and the possession and firing of the gun was legal, though there's currently no law preventing the two from being joined for private use. Drone regulations are evolving as the technology becomes more widespread, and frequently hobbyists are finding new ways to use them that have not been evaluated before.
Last week, firefighters in California had a hard time dropping buckets from helicopters due to hobby drones that were taking pictures of a fire that had jumped the freeway, increasing the time between drops by as much as 30 minutes. The FAA has begun laying down regulations for commercial use of drone technology, allowing only a select few companies to participate in the pilot program. In the meantime, recreational users of drones are experiencing a sort of Wild West, where new ways to use the technology are coming faster than our ability to predict and regulate problems. The FAA was expected to have new rules for recreational drone use by September. However, it is unlikely that they will meet that deadline.
A lawsuit was filed in Arizona today that challenges the current right of police officers to permanently seize personal property with no criminal charges filed. The lawsuit is being filed by Rhonda Cox after her truck was seized and sold because the police alleged it was involved in a crime. There were no charges against her, and the police station kept the funds attained after selling her truck. The Arizona law is unique because the funds from the seizure go directly to the law enforcement. Lawyers for Rhonda Cox claim this encourages law enforcement to seize more assets than is necessary, as the enforcement gets a direct benefit. In 2013, over 85% of the funds in Pinal County, Arizona, came from forfeiture funds. In 2012, seizures accounted for over 90% of the funds received. Jeffrey Zimmerman, an asset forfeiture lawyer, describes the laws in Arizona as, quote, highway robbery, unquote.
Critics of Canada's new anti-terrorism laws have submitted an appeal to the Ontario Supreme Court in order to have the new standards overturned. The largest objections to the rules involve vague language and an opportunity for the government to censor free speech. The goal of the legislation is intended to help government agencies track and monitor potential terrorist threats. Activists argue that the laws open up a path for mass data collection without accountability. Furthermore, it creates secretive no-fly lists and allows the government to determine what is considered propaganda and have it seized or destroyed. Language that aims to target propaganda items could be used to describe anyone that may disagree with the government, and therefore many activists feel that these laws may be manipulated to target their speech. Advocates for freedom of the press and some civil liberties groups have joined together to fight the bill and have started a GoFundMe to help raise money for their legal defense. As of now, that fund has reached over $13,000 in donations from supporters and activists.
The Portland City Council today addressed the issue of the numerous unpaved streets in the city. But some local residents took issue with the fact that they will be required to pay for sewer hookup when their street is paved, to the tune of up to $70,000 per household. Here's a clip of the testimony from today's city council meeting.
I live on 4515 Northeast 936 off this, and I oppose this so-called improvement. I'm not interested in it. It's half the value of my property. I'll never be able to make up that cost of $77,803. That for 100 feet, that's pretty expensive for a sidewalk. I never talked to this other guy ever. I've been living there for over 20 years. So, the previous guy. I got this notice because of my neighbor, not because of this anybody else. And it's just too hard to ship for me to pay $77,000 for a little bit of sidewalk. And that's what I have to say. Thank you.
And the sanitary sewer connection, is that of any interest to you?
Not really. I have the sewer, and it's been working just fine for all these years.
I'm Kyle Snuggerud. I own the property at 4525 Northeast 136th. We were not notified. Previously, the one that happened years ago, we were notified. Andrew knows exactly how to get a hold of me. He has before. I got notified by the signs on the street. That's when I was first notified. So I went up and down the street, notified everybody. Because if I wasn't notified, I would think nobody else probably was correctly. So we did that, but we are opposing it. We did last time. As you stated, the property value is not there for this. It's not there. It's not going to bring the property value up that much. Oscar, the person that's on the opposite side of the street, I know he's out of the state for the last month and a half. So trying to notify him, it probably wasn't there. I know he opposed it last time. Signature, she is also opposing it. She's on a fixed income. She would go into bankruptcy and be homeless if she was faced that LID. It's just the cost that they're imposing is too much for what the property's worth.
A couple of things come to mind. When we saw the sign, that's when we kicked into action about how to address the LID and the impact, the financial impact that it would have on our company. And as I think he's your staffer, Mr. Abbey, specified that there was no one that was opposed to it. Well, a couple things about that. Number one, as you pointed out, Commissioner Fritz, President Fritz, sorry, is the fact that he got zero response or practically no response, and in particular, no remonstrance, no official remonstrance from anyone. Well, had we known, we looked on the city website, we looked through the ordinances, I found information on the resolution, city council resolution that discussed this, and had we known that there was a deadline for remonstrance, we would have been proactive about that. Our assumption was that today was the deadline for remonstrance, and so that's why we're here. In spite of the fact that Mr. Abbey's attempted to contact all the property owners, not everyone's been contacted, and not everybody that has an interest in it has had a chance to remonstrate against it if they so choose.
That was testimony from today's city council meeting in Portland.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. This will be followed by The Underground, KBOO's program for youth, by youth talking this month about nature at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is mostly sunny with a high of 82, moving to clear skies and 57 at night. Today in history, in 1944, in opposition to the Polish government in exile, the Soviet-sponsored Polish Committee of National Liberation published its manifesto, calling for radical reforms, a continuation of fighting in World War II against Nazi Germany, nationalization of industry, and a decent border in the West. The quote of the day is from Terry Pratchett. The trouble with having an open mind, of course, is that people will come along and try to put things in it.
It's 5:26, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Novelist Thomas Wolfe famously wrote, "You can't go home again." But Eric Holder has proven him wrong. Holder, who was President Obama's Attorney General until stepping down earlier this year, recently returned to his old home place, Covington and Burling. Where's that? Well, it's not actually a place, but a powerhouse Washington lobbying and corporate lawyering outfit. It runs interference in Washington for such Wall Street clients as Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo, and it's a place where Holder definitely feels at home. After serving as a deputy attorney general in the 1990s, where he demonstrated a kind and gentle approach to prosecuting corporate crime, Holder was invited in 2001 to leave his government job and join the corporate covey of Covington and Burling lawyers. There, he happily hauled water for big-name corporations until tapped to re-enter the government in 2009 as AG. The most striking thing about his six-year run as America's top lawyer was his ever-so-delicate treatment of the Wall Street banksters who crashed our economy in 2008. Despite blatant cases of massive fraud and finagling, Holder failed to prosecute even one of the top Wall Streeters involved. Indeed, he generously deprioritized criminal prosecution of mortgage fraud and even publicly embraced the soft-on-corporate crime notion that Wall Street banks are too big to fail and too big to jail. It's no surprise, then, that Holder is once again spinning through the revolving door of government service to rejoin his corporate family at Covington and Burling. In fact, in his years away, the firm kept a primo corner office empty for him, awaiting his return home. This is Jim Hightower saying, in a way, he never really left. But now, his paycheck for serving corporate interests will be many millions of dollars a year. Happy homecoming, Eric. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The City Council of Santa Barbara, California, unanimously voted yesterday to restart a desalination plant to help mitigate the effects of the four-year-old drought. The plant has been in standby mode since the 1990s. It takes water from the ocean and uses reverse osmosis to produce drinking water. The plant could provide nearly 40% of Santa Barbara's water. But some climate change activists criticize the idea that this process is the answer to human-caused climate change, especially droughts. Maud Barlow, a water and human rights activist, claimed there are three main issues with desalination plants. They are very expensive to set up and run, they are intensely energy dependent, and the leftover salt brine is dumped back into the ocean, which will ultimately worsen the problem. Other groups point out that California is rapidly running out of options when it comes to water use, and all technologies and solutions must be considered. But the California Water Impact Network, a coalition of environmental groups, has proposed another solution, retiring large swaths of overused agricultural farmland. This would save the state up to $1 billion and save 450,000 acres of water. This amount is about two-thirds of the annual water usage in the city of Los Angeles.
And now for a look at the week in water, brought to you by H2O Radio.
Exxon misled the public about fossil fuels. That and other stories for the week ending July 12, 2015.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Since 1981, ExxonMobil knew that their operations were causing global warming. But instead of sharing their concerns, they misled the public and politicians.
In fact, the oil giant had been funding studies by climate change deniers. A new report from the Union of Concerned Scientists reveals the company's own internal documents and memos.
For example, an internal memo at Mobil in 1995 said, "The scientific basis for the greenhouse effect and the potential impact of human emissions of greenhouse gases such as CO2 on climate is well established and cannot be denied."
Nevertheless, Exxon publicly refused to acknowledge climate change for 10 more years and continued to provide financial support for climate change denial.
According to research carried out by Greenpeace, Exxon spent over $30 million on think tanks and researchers who promoted climate change denial.
Some have likened the fossil fuel industry's conduct to that of tobacco companies that for decades resisted the evidence that smoking causes cancer.
Last Thursday, the California Council on Science and Technology and the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab released a report into the practice of hydraulic fracturing.
The report looked at all aspects of fracking in the Golden State and contains recommendations, some of which state that there must be much more study about the hazards from this controversial industry.
But while fracking is still allowed to continue, the report states that the risks associated with about two-thirds of the chemicals used in the process are not clear.
Furthermore, the toxicity of more than half of those chemicals remains uninvestigated, unmeasured, and unknown. And basic information about how these chemicals move through the environment doesn't exist.
The report also concludes that certain operations need to stop now. For example, some operators currently dispose of wastewater from fracked wells in percolation pits, and some have occasionally injected wastewater contaminated with fracking chemicals into protected groundwater.
The report also raises concern about using oil-filled water in agriculture. One of the authors told the LA Times that he was surprised to learn that recycled oiled wastewater was being used on crops. He questioned whether we can assure farmers and consumers that their food is healthy until the safety of this water is known.
Tens of thousands of people in Kosovo were without water on Saturday morning over fears the Islamic State, or ISIS, had poisoned a reservoir there.
The water supply company in the capital, Pristina, said it had turned off its treatment facility after police arrested three men behaving suspiciously near the Badovac Reservoir.
Al Jazeera is reporting that tests carried out by the Kosovo Institute for National Health had detected no sign of toxic content. The reservoir supplies drinking water to more than 200,000 people.
Kosovo had been on a heightened state of alert in recent weeks after propaganda videos surfaced interest showing Balkan members of the terror group warning of attacks, including the poisoning of water supplies. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Users of the popular cheating website Ashley Madison have been left in a panic after the website was hacked. The company is known for the slogan, "Life's too short, have an affair." Hackers claim to have stolen the personal information of millions of users. The data the hackers claim to have includes names, addresses, credit card information, pictures, and explicit depictions of fantasies. The hackers call themselves Impact Team, and they did it for a reason that you may not expect. The hacking group is upset about the Ashley Madison's permanent delete feature, which they say is false. Users of the website are given an option to permanently delete their information for a fee of $19. This $19 fee makes up over $1 million of the company's annual income, and it's these permanently deleted profiles that the hackers say they have gained access to. The group states that unless the entire site is taken offline, that they will release the personal information of millions of users. Ashley Madison is ranked as the second largest dating site on the internet, with Match.com coming in first. The company that owns this site says that it has a value of $1 billion and made $115 million last year. The company is working with law enforcement and IT professionals to remove portions of the data that have already been posted on the internet. Internet experts recommend that everyone practice safety when using the internet, and in general, people should understand that what goes online frequently stays online.
Senate Republicans, in writing a must-do spending bill, proposed to roll back some of the regulations imposed 5 years ago that seek to prevent another financial crisis. The 2010 Dodd-Frank law set limits on the size of banks and regulated mortgage lending laws. Banks deemed too big to fail must meet extra requirements for the amount of capital on hand. The spending bill would drastically raise the threshold for too big to fail. Chris Coons, a Delaware Democrat, said that the move would dismantle Wall Street reforms that have helped protect consumers. The bill was passed through a Senate committee today, but will likely need to go through other committees for markups and amendments before going to the full Senate for approval.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
This is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1887. That was the day brewery workers in San Francisco declared victory after brewery owners gave in to their demands. The demands were as follows: free beer, a closed shop, freedom to live outside the breweries, a 10-hour workday, a 6-day work week, and a board of arbitration. Brewery workers in that city maintained their union loyalty. During the 2 years that followed, the National Brewers Association sought to break the brewers' unions across the nation. But the brewers stood strong in San Francisco. The Brewery Owners Association ordered its affiliated members in San Francisco to fire union workers and replace them with scabs. This led to a 9-month brewer workers strike. The strike was successful. The National Brewers Association finally was forced to capitulate. There have been other more recent brewery strikes, and not just in the United States. In 2010, Carlsberg brewery workers went on strike in Denmark after bosses told the staff they could only drink at lunchtime. The warehouse and production workers in Denmark were rebelling against the company's new alcohol policy. Previously, workers could help themselves to beer throughout the day from coolers placed around the work sites. According to a company spokesman, the only restriction was that you could not be drunk at work, which was up to each and everyone to be responsible. On July 9, 2015, Polar brewery workers went on strike in Venezuela because the company delayed signing a contract and refused to recognize the union. The four Polar breweries make 80% of Venezuela's beer. There's no shortage of beer in that country. Venezuela is one of the 10 largest consumers of beer in the world.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Yeah. And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Joining the Fight for 15 movement, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors Tuesday took the first step in raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour in unincorporated parts of the county. Monica Lopez reports from Los Angeles.
The wage increase will apply to all employers, including nonprofits, and will be phased in over the next 5 years. The first increase to $10.50 an hour will take effect on July 1, 2016. Employers with fewer than 26 employees will have an additional year to phase in their wage increases. Rusty Hicks, Secretary Treasurer of the LA County Federation of Labor, addressed the board before Tuesday's vote.
Is it a good or a bad thing that 37% of workers in the county make less than $15 an hour when a single person needs more than $15 an hour just to survive? I would argue that these are bad things.
LA's newest city council member, Marquise Harris Dawson, described the result of a business survey in his district.
Small businesses in my community said resoundingly, yeah, I don't like the idea of having to pay more in wages, but what's more important to me is to have customers that can actually afford to buy the goods and services that I'm selling.
Supervisors are also working on a wage enforcement plan with city and county agencies. Monica Lopez, Workers Independent News, Los Angeles.
New York's wage board is expected Wednesday to announce its findings on raising the minimum wage for fast food workers. Fight for 15 workers pushing for a union and a $15 minimum wage in other states and cities will rally in support of the New York fast food workers on Thursday. Governor Andrew Cuomo appointed the wage board, and it's expected to make its recommendations after weeks of public testimony from workers who said their pay is so low now they rely on public assistance, squeeze into crowded apartments, and are unable to afford the necessities for themselves and their children. Most non-tenured faculty at Barnard College will be able to vote on whether or not to join United Auto Workers 2110 in September. The college signed a neutrality agreement that came on the last day of NLRB hearings to determine which employees would be in the bargaining unit for the election. Sonam Singh is an adjunct lecturer at Barnard.
Currently, the pay is very low, a few thousand dollars per course, and there's no stability because adjuncts are only appointed semester to semester, which leads to a lot of precariousness in terms of, you know, or any kind of financial planning. A system had developed over time where a lot of inequity had crept into it, and a union seemed like the most reasonable and effective way to address those inequities.
Barnard President Deborah Spar says the administration fully supports the right of the contingent faculty to make a decision for themselves and without interference when it comes to joining a union. WIN is made possible in part through underwriting support from the United Steelworkers and from the International Association of Machinists. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Afghan government reports that at least 10 Taliban fighters, including their commander, were killed in clashes with security forces in western Farah province on Monday night. The clashes took place near a military base in the Gulistan district of the province after Taliban fighters attacked the military base. Also Monday, U.S. forces carried out an airstrike targeting the Afghan National Army, killing 7. The U.S. bomb was dropped on an Afghan military checkpoint in the central Logar province of Afghanistan. It's not clear at this point if the bombing of the army checkpoint was accidental or if the U.S. military was intentionally targeting the Afghan military base. And that's your latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan.
You're listening to the KBOO. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Catherine Maticek, Joseph Jordan, Jimmy Tardy, and Joe Aaron. The producer is Galen Sanford. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issues you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something and write it down. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Joseph Jordan.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty hosts Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, the guest is Jeff Kohler, author of Darjeeling, the story of how Darjeeling tea began. And at 11:30, the film show visits Oregon's drive-in theaters. Tune in and find out where to bring your roadster, your bike, or even your two legs to a screening under the stars. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a KBOO member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned for news from the Boo.
And now it's time for KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.
Yes, it is that time again, Wednesday at about 5:45 p.m. We're going to get the lowdown on what's going on around and inside KBOO. Today we have station co-manager Mike with us. Good evening, Mike.
Good evening, Erin. How's it going?
Pretty good, pretty good. So you have a couple of guests here in the studio. Do you want to introduce them?
Sure. I have Brother Antoine Tolbert and Brother Edie Mondelet. And they came to join us today to tell us about an event that's going to be happening in the community that KBOO is a co-sponsor of, called We Can Do It Together. And that event is on August 8th.